anesthesia without feeling. So we're going to target a particular area, a localized area, and make it without feeling. But in particular, what feeling is it that we are trying to eliminate? Pain. And we'll talk a little bit about the fact that while we are eliminating pain, we are eliminating a lot of other things as well. Okay. Local anesthesia. Now what is it that we are doing when we talk about local anesthesia? Okay. What we are doing and what these chemicals do is they block the physiologic neuronal process that we call conduction. Whether it be autonomics or central, when we talk about interfering with the nervous system, as you're probably becoming more and more aware, we're generally talking about transmission. We're going to screw up transmission somehow, whether it be on the giving end, presynaptically, or whether it be on the receiving end, postsynaptically, we're fooling around with transmission. This is the exception. These drugs don't deal with transmission, they deal with conduction. And then in parentheses, put at physiologic or therapeutic doses. And you can probably be one jump ahead of me and tell where I'm going with that. What about higher doses? Well, guess what? They start screwing around with transmission. We'll talk about that. But it's conduction at physiologic or therapeutic doses, okay? Now, first thing to understand is in all of the animal kingdom, it's not just are you female or male, are you Afro-American or Caucasian, I don't care if you're a mouse. If you conduct, I have a neuron that's conducting, it's conducting the exact same way. If there's an action potential, how do you produce it? Sodium goes one way, potassium goes the other. That's the way it goes. It's not calcium, it's not magnesium, it's not strontium, it's not gold. What is it? Sodium and potassium. All nerves conduct the same way. All neurons conduct the same way. So, the first point to understand is that you apply it to a neuron, it's going to work. Okay? Conduction. And they all conduct the same way. Chemically, these compounds, and toward the back of that section on local anesthetics, I've got a little chart that looks like this. I mean, this isn't inclusive, it's not necessarily up to date, but it gives you the idea, and I'll let the chemists do all the chemical bit. Chemically, what they are, you'll notice, is a substituted amino acetate group, okay? And on the other side, we've got para-amino up in here, benzoic acid. You notice the blue I've got drawn in there. We'll get to that in a second. Para-amino benzoic acid, and it's an esterified, got the ester group there on the benzoate, to generally an ethyl, an amino ethyl that's also substituted. Okay? That's the basic structure chemically. Okay? Now, a couple of things. How do we eliminate or get rid of local anesthetics? Well, for the most part, we depend upon them being broken apart by esterases. Okay? Which are fairly common, predominant throughout the body. And so one of the things they'll talk about in med chem, we learned fairly quickly, fairly early on, that if, and that's where this comes in, if we make it an amide linkage rather than an ester linkage, amidases are not as prevalent. They are not as common, and they are not in as high a concentration. So it takes longer to get rid of that particular compound in terms of metabolism or biotransformation, if you will. It is very rare for any of these compounds to be biotransformed in the liver or to be gotten rid of by the kidney because of the presence throughout the body of these enzymes. Okay? They are applied local, they get biotransformed or metabolized local for the most part. The only other way in which we would lose activity is for them to just kind of float away in the circulation. You got that? Now with esters, one of the things we have done historically in order to try and increase duration of action is to minimize circulation. That is, we put a vasoconstrictor in the product along with the anesthetic to minimize blood flow through that particular area. Enzymes have a tougher time getting in, and or the compound is not as easily carried away in the circulation. Thus, we increase duration of action. Epinephrine is a commonly used product with a number of these particularly ester types of compounds. Okay? Now, where do I want to go next? Oh, yeah. I turned at 90 degrees. I'm going to use this term somewhat commonly throughout the rest of the course. But you'll notice I've thrown a couple of benzene rings, aryl rings, on this basic structure. And what I generally call this is a kite. You notice we've got a body of a kite with a tail hanging off of it. A kite. And what I want to tell you, you know, is I keep it simple. You know, KISS with two S's, I keep it simple because I'm, you can say it loudly, I won't dock you. Okay? And so I think of a kite. And you'll discover as we go through this part of the course, and if you look back to the autonomic part of the course, if you are looking at a blocking compound, if you are looking at an anti-compound, something with good affinity and how much efficacy, preferably zero, okay, those compounds almost always, you know, this is the weasel words, this is pharmacology, almost always have a kite-like shape or structure. We'll talk about antidepressant, a whole group of antidepressant compounds called tricyclic antidepressants. The classic antipsychotic compounds have a tricyclic ring structure. A number of the newer anti-muscarinics have a tricyclic ring structure. Kite. And so it is not beyond the realm of possibility, depending on what those R groups are toward the right of that benzene ring, to have a mini kite here. What I'm saying is one of the issues with and a localized anesthesia is that if you get enough of it systemically, one of the major problems, one of the major side effect issues, resolve around anti. Okay? Blocking. The nice thing is, it's peripheral blocking. Because after all, we're looking at an ester or an amide, we're looking at a fairly polar compound, it's not getting into the central nervous system, thank goodness, most of the time. We'll have an exception or two, but most of the time it's peripheral blocking activities that become big issues. Alpha blockade, and what it does to the cardiovascular can be an issue. Muscarinic blockade can be an issue. Okay, so we've got these compounds. We try and apply them locally to act locally in terms of blockade. Neuron. Okay. What we are going to do is block. Okay? This is generally an afferent going in. A pain afferent. We block so that the whatever response, ouch, is starting here, does not get down to here. So we don't recognize it as ouch. Okay? We could block it here, we could block it here, we could block it on the next neuron in line if we have that opportunity. I don't care where we block it, we're not going to get an ouch. Anything downstream is going to be blocked. Okay? Now, we've got another, whoa, I'm sorry. Somebody's screaming, my AV ability goes out the toilet, okay? We've got another way we can do this, right? We got another way we can do this. Snip, snip. Just cut the neuron. What's the nice thing about doing it chemically? It is reversible. Okay? So, here we have a neuron. Here we have a syringe. We inject it. And what is it that happens pharmacologically? Okay? Mechanism of action is blockade of sodium channels. The interesting thing is, it is from the inside. Not the outside, the inside. So that means that in order to be effective, what does the compound have to be able to do? Cross the neuronal membrane. So it has to have some lipophilicity as well as hydrophilicity. Oh shoot, I forgot one statement. Doc Dorn. I'm heading back here. There's a corollary here. What did I say side effect was all about with these compounds? Anti-effects, blockade. Okay? The corollary is that there are a number of antimuscarinics. There are a number of anxiolytics that we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks. There are a number of antidepressants that have local anesthetic efficacy. And so just as local anesthetics can have issues side effect-wise in terms of blockade, so can a number of these compounds, particularly at super high doses, have side effect issues revolving around what type of action? Local anesthesia. which isn't so local in that one. Okay, but we'll be talking about that when we talk about those compounds. Now back to where I was. Okay? So we've injected our compound. It's got to get across the neuronal membrane. Much easier if there's no myelin sheath. In those types of nerves, guess where the local anesthetic does its job? Hello? We even had some anatomy here. At the nodes of Ranvier, where the myelin sheath is not as thick, that's where it'll go. Luckily, those nodes happen every so often. We don't have to, it's not like trying to find a stud in the wall. Just inject it and you'll get a node or two, okay? But that's how that goes. So physiologically, these things get across, and, you know, I don't know if you remember if it's Dr. Lovstead or Dr. Boncher, but they'll talk about equilibriums, you know, what kind of PK they have to have in order to do their thing. That was one of the things we had to, do is make sure PK values were good. So that we could get enough of the compound into the neuron, into the cytoplasm of that axon, to then turn around and block from the inside. Okay? Now, the next thing from a physiologic standpoint, as I said, all neurons are susceptible. The fact of the matter is, some neurons are more susceptible than others. The reason for that is that, despite the constancy of pi d being the circumference of a circle, okay, generally speaking, the smaller nerve fibers tend to have a greater volume per surface area than larger fibers. And so, because of that differential, if you will, smaller nerve fibers tend to be more susceptible. That is, they tend to get higher internal concentrations and hold them than larger nerve fibers. All right, so here's a nerve. Remember I said, except for the reticular activating system, most nerves look like a cord, okay, just lay one on top of another, there would be the possibility of differentially taking out just the smaller fibers and leaving the larger ones to be unaffected. But the fact of the matter is we say, screw it, that's too tough. We'll just wipe them all out. And that's how it goes. So if we were good, what we would take out are these on the bottom. And so if you are Let me do it this way. How many of you go to a dentist that uses local anesthesia? An injection. Raise your hands high. Okay? So if that dentist were good, he or she would be able to just take out the bottom two or three. Yeah, you'd lose some postganglionic sympathetics. Efferents, not afferents. We don't care about that. Unless it gets generalized systemic, then we might have a blood pressure issue and cardiac issue, but if it's just local, screw it. postganglionic sympathetics, pain. Pain and temperature, just do that and the rest go on through. But the fact of the matter is that dentists give you enough to take out the whole nerve. So that a common problem when I go to the dentist, which is too often, okay, after I get out of the dental chair, if I try and eat something, part of my meal is tongue. Has anybody else had that experience? Because what is wiped out? Proprioception. Way up at the top. What is proprioception? Your ability to distinguish where one body part is in relation to another. In this case, tongue vis-a-vis jaw. So we take out the whole nerve, basically. And of course, as this is occurring, when you make the injection, the dentist will pull back on the syringe a little bit, hopefully, if they're good. Make sure we're not in a blood vessel. We don't want to give it systemically. Where do we want it? Local. Injection. And after about 10, 15 minutes, we take out everything. All right? Now, next thing. Now what happens as the afferent motor and pain nerves are built is that neurons will fall and lie on the surface of the nerve bundle. So this is my favorite part of this course, okay? Up in the axillary region, which neurons are at the very center? These neurons. What's about halfway out? The forearm. Then lying on top of that, the elbow, then the upper arm, and finally at the very surface of the bundle, what's in the shoulder or axillary area, okay? So as you apply the local anesthetic to this nerve bundle up here, you're going to lose sensations, whether it be pain, proprioception, or whatever, proximal to distal, as the local anesthetic penetrates into that neuron, or nerve at this point, mixed nerve. What does it hit in highest concentration initially? The outside. What is the last to go? The inside. This is the last to go. It's proximal to distal. And in like manner, what do the enzymes and the floating away into the circulation happens first? At the surface. So not only is sensation, whether it be pain or whatever, lost proximal to distal, but it's regained proximal to distal. Now in terms of dental work, that doesn't mean a whole lot, but dentistry is only one area where we utilize local anesthetics commonly. Thank you. statements, then let's just talk a little bit about pharmacology. After all, that's what the course is named. Pharmacology, of course, if done correctly, is one thing: block conduction. Okay. Unfortunately, sometimes mistakes or errors occur, not so much in the dentist's office, but in other areas, and so we have some issues. Let's just talk some major pharmacology. CNS. As I said before, generally fairly difficult for these things to get into the central nervous system, but it does happen, particularly with some. Initially, these things are CNS stimulants. Now that seems kind of intuitively bass-ackwards. It looks as if you remember that general depressive chart I showed a couple of days ago, it looks as if, at least centrally, inhibitory influences tend to be more easily affected in the CNS. So we've got inhibition of an inhibitory or blockade of conduction of an inhibitory influence. The net result of two minuses is stimulation. That's kind of where we go with that. Okay? Particularly in the medulla, is this true? Centers tend to be stimulated initially. So we see bradycardia. We see a mild hypertension despite the bradycardia, as the vasomotor center gets stimulated. Some increase in respiratory function, particularly rate. And this may evolve, if you will, into cortical stimulation. The prototype local anesthetic, cocaine. And it tends to be the real problem in terms of CNS effects. Gets into the CNS pretty good. And you see even cortical stimulation, and this is one of the reasons why it's abused. But of course, to get cortical stimulation, you first have medullary stimulation, and of course, we ought to, you know, read about or know about people that even with a first or second dose of cocaine will get into cardiovascular trouble because of the strong stimulation in the medullary area while they're trying to get it to the cortex. Like a number of other agents that we're going to talk about, this initial stimulation is followed by a rather pronounced depression. As the true nature of the compound, blocking conduction, blocking transmission, comes to the fore. The depression is predominant with the respiratory center. So respiratory depression tends to become the big issue. A compound that we'll be talking about in a few weeks, Valium or diazepam, is now the compound of choice to counteract any motor tremor or mild convulsions during the stimulatory phase of overdose with local anesthetics. The reason for that, it has no respiratory depressant activity to speak of. We used to use general depressants, but the respiratory depressant activity of those compounds would be intensified by the local anesthetic if we went into this respiratory depressant mode. Hypotension. B12 becomes a big issue. Okay? Some of the above, all of the above. You know, those kinds of questions. Why are we getting hypotension? Medullary vasomotor depression? Direct smooth muscle depression? Alpha blockade. Can it get any better than that? Hypo tension. Okay? But again, that tends to be, you know, I say this kind of jokingly, that tends to be the relatively minor problem compared to the respiratory depression. Okay. I'm not trying to minimize the seriousness of it, but respiratory depression. We also will see at higher doses a neuromuscular junction blockade. One of the things we have to worry about, we'll talk about in maybe a few minutes yet today, using these compounds for surgery. A lot of people don't want general anesthesia, don't want to be gassed, don't want to be out, so what do they opt for? Some sort of spinal anesthesia. But what do we try and add to that? An anxiolytic, a neuromuscular blocker. Okay. Just mention a few of the compounds of historical note. 1874 is the key date here. Cocaine is the compound, and its local anesthetic activity was discovered by a gentleman by the name of Kohler, K-O-L-L-E-R. Kohler was an ophthalmologist. And he kind of discovered when working on one of his patients, a coke addict of some note. The patient's name was Sigmund Freud. Discovered that he could do tonometric. You know, you go to the ophthalmologist, they blast you with that little thing of air or bounce something off your eyeball to, you know, find out the internal pressure. Nice, pleasant experience, right? Well, he was doing that. Freud did not have a problem blinking or anything else. He was kind of going, and Kohler said, well, geez, what's going on here? He kind of figured out it was the cocaine, so he started using it in ophthalmologic procedures, and it soon spread to local anesthesia in various ways, particularly dentistry. We don't use cocaine anymore medically. Why? Long-acting CNS effects. It gets in there. Euphoria tends to be an issue. Cortical stimulation. Euphoria tends to be the big issue. There's an addictive liability. And kind of uniquely among the local anesthetics, cocaine inhibits catecholamine reuptake. You guys talk about Wellbutrin at all and those kinds of compounds when you talk sympathetics? Huh? Well, things that block neuronal reuptake? No? Yes? I got one yes. Okay. Good enough for me. His fault. Yeah, this falls in that category. Okay? Blocking neuronal reuptake. All right. Another thing that cocaine tends to do that sometimes may get us into trouble is it tends to stimulate the hypothalamic temperature regulation thermostat. It can be pyrogenic, particularly in overdose. Our heat dissipating mechanisms tend to shut down. Our heat generating mechanisms tend to be stimulated, which can do, you're pretty much aware of the fact that all of our body processes are geared to work most efficiently, most optimally, within fairly narrow homeostatic limits. Among those limits are temperature limits. And so if we get too hot or too cold, we have issues. Okay? And that can be a problem with cocaine. Now, remember I said 1874, so the last quarter of the 19th century, that's what we have. It's in 1905 that we discover another compound. This compound is called procaine. It's given the trade name Novocaine. It's a basic ester, and it becomes the prototype, if you will, for all of the other compounds, and there's been about 20 to 25 of them that have come on the market since then. And it's the one at the top of this chart, procaine. Okay, Novocaine. And you notice that basically it is pyrimenobenzoic acid with a couple of substitutions on here on the other side of the upper group. Procaine. One thing, it's an ester, fairly short duration. When Novocaine is used anymore, it's generally used with epinephrine. After it's hydrolyzed, the left-hand portion is para-aminobenzoic acid. A compound that a number of different bacteria utilize rather extensively for metabolism and other purposes. When the sulfa drugs were first developed, sulfa drugs act to inhibit bacterial growth and replication by inhibiting para-aminobenzoic acid. And so local anesthetics like procaine tended to be counterindicated, tended to work against sulfa, and vice versa. Okay? Other thing I want to say about procaine is it becomes the prototype for, let's try and extend the duration of action, and the compound becomes procaine amide. Procainamide, pretty self-explanatory. And procainamide becomes not only a longer-acting local anesthetic, but it becomes a prototype of an anti-arrhythmic compound. It becomes used for certain types of arrhythmias during a long period of time. And from procainamide, we develop an anti-arrhythmic compound that's used quite a bit. Dr. Potter will be talking about next semester, called lidocaine. Trade name for lidocaine is xylocaine. Another amide linkage, another compound that, while used as a local anesthetic to some extent, has found more utility in the anti-arrhythmic area. Now, segue to Wednesday about uses of these compounds. Three major areas. And I want to go first to the third area. That'll make a better segue. If I wasn't this far along, I'd go another direction. But we're going to talk basically for a minute about this chart. Black anesthesia. Okay, block anesthesia. Three major types of block anesthesia. The first two get through fairly easily. Why? Dentistry. Blocking afferent nerves in the teeth. Mainly trying to block pain. No big deal. Just remember all the nerve fibers are blocked. You're going to chew your tongue afterwards. Understand that. There are some efferents that are blocked in terms of saliva production and those types of things, but relatively minor. Okay. Second way in which we often see block anesthesia utilized is in obstetrics. Okay. One type of obstetric block is called the, I'll just write it on here, pudendo block. Pudenda is the fancy term for the external female genitalia, particularly the labia. And pudendal can be used. Often, no, I won't say because I don't have a percentage which is more, it may be, instead of pudendal, a paracervical block. That is, now we are not going to block just the surface structures, but we're going to block the whole vaginal canal up to and including the cervix. This may be used. What we're dealing with here is, I don't know whether to say common or what, but let's just say often. I know my daughter's done it every time. As the fetus is delivered, there will be a tearing, particularly those delicate tissues between the vaginal opening and the anal opening. Rip or tear because of the size of the infant. And so we use this block for stitching of those areas following delivery. It may also be used if there are other complications, but often as the placenta is delivered, post-delivery of the baby, the uterus may partially be expelled as well, and we have to get that back in place. So that's where this type of blockade is used. Now, if we are going to do like a cesarean, then we start looking at blocking with a third type of block, and that's known as spinal anesthesia. And while we talk about a spinal in terms of obstetrics commonly, remember, spinal anesthesia can also be used for most abdominal surgery and a lot of thoracic surgery as well. And again, spinal is often used in patients who have a morbid fear of being put to sleep with an anesthetic. Sometimes that fear is justified. they've had a general anesthetic before, and it has not been a good experience for one reason or another. So they opt for spinal anesthesia. Now, the big thing about spinal anesthesia is that you can go one of two ways, and this is the segue to tomorrow. You can either go outside around the arachnoid covering, the arachnoid layer, this is generally called an epidural, around the dura, or you can go inside the dura, what's known as a subdural or intrathecal block. And the statement I want to leave you with is, remember I said one of the issues with local anesthetics is so they can have issues crossing the blood-brain barrier. Well, what have you done with an intrathecal block? You physically pass the blood-brain barrier. You said, we'll put it right in there. So that has some issues. That's where we'll pick up then on Wednesday.